her keys.
It's her job to come find it, so I'm sure she will.
Yeah, I hope she has my cell phone, because I was supposed to leave it in my office and I forgot. It's in my car, though.
All right, good morning, colleagues. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. This afternoon, is March 6, 2017, and we're going to be opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5534, Public Employee Retirement System. John, what do we need to know about this?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. Today you'll begin hearing PERS. They'll start with an agency overview this morning of the system, and then followed by 2 days of agency-specific presentations. Hopefully we'll maybe be able to finish a little bit early on Wednesday, and Linnea will do the CFO's presentation. And then if not, we will go into Thursday. We will have the earnings crediting report work session on Thursday. The materials will be posted 24 hours in advance on Wednesday, and then finish up with public testimony and whatever cleanup has to be done to finish PERS up for the week. Thank you, Co-Chair.
Perfect. Thank you, sir. All right. Who's coming up? All right. Come on up. So the two things we're asking, especially as it relates to the public employee retirement system, is one, if do everything you can to avoid acronyms, okay? And then two, what I think would be really, really helpful for this committee is as you're communicating with us, those opportunities to share with us things are in statute or there's a reason why certain things occur the way they do. It might help a committee who's new to Ways and Means and new to this legislative process.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith, and good afternoon, everyone. My name is Steve Rodman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement System.
Sure. Linnea Whittakin with DAS CFO.
The floor is all yours.
Thank you. So, and thank you, Co-Chair, for that mindfulness of the introduction for many of these committee members. I know I am new to many of you, and I apologize that I haven't gotten around to you, but with the hearing moving up a week, I had some appointments scheduled that instead we'll just go right into the real thing. So I have a presentation that's prepared. I'll talk off of it generally as we go through, but please feel free to interrupt with questions or clarifications, and I will, thank you, Co-Chair Smith, I try to avoid acronyms and abbreviations. I know how challenging that can be. So what's important in looking at the public employees retirement system is understanding the partnerships and understanding the responsibilities. And we'll go into a lot more detail about the component parts and how we look at the system and how we assess it. But fundamentally, the partnerships are between the agency itself, which is a state agency under the executive branch of the state government, and public employers who have elected to join into PERS. Now, many of those elections were decades ago, but some of those elections are relatively recent, and actually new employers join us all the time. Charter schools or new districts and things that come into being have the choice of offering PERS. So we administer our benefit plan for the public employers that we serve, and we serve 95% probably of the public employees in the state of Oregon. There are a few other plans out there that cover public employees, but they are few and far between. The other important partnership, though, and the reason that we are a different sort of an agency than you'll see, is our relationship with our membership. The public employee retirement system is administers a public employee benefit trust, and that benefit trust is governed quite a bit by federal law over the purpose of the trust and some of the constraints over what it can and cannot do. The main point to emphasize about the trust aspect of PERS is that we are beholden to our membership in terms of the funds that we do, that we expend, the costs and services that we provide. We have as a paramount responsibility, our fiduciary responsibility to our membership. It also means that the funds in the trust are there for the exclusive benefit of members. In other words, the some $70 billion that has been set aside over the years of the trust being in existence have to be expended only for the benefit of members. They cannot be used for any other purpose. So that again, sort of sets PERS apart from other kinds of state agencies in that fiduciary responsibility we have and also in the dedicated nature of the funds that we administer. Very often people think of PERS as a state retirement system, and yes, we do cover state employees, but if you look there in the lower left about our membership by employer, states and universities and judges are only about 60,000 of the over 134,000 members that we serve. By far, our largest membership component is schools. All of the school districts, all the school employees are all members of PERS. And then units of local government, cities, counties, special districts comprise another large share of the membership base that we have. So while, again, we are looked at as a state agency, thought of as a state retirement system, we are really a public employee retirement system. We serve all different types and all different types of employers. You have large, sophisticated employers like the state, but we also have very small employers who their member of PERS maybe spends a little bit of time on bookkeeping, but spends most of the time clearing the weeds out of the irrigation ditches. So that level of sophistication and education has to be adjusted as we work with all sorts of different sizes of employers. Membership by program I'll go into a little bit more when I go into the next slide about what the different benefit components are. But the main point, again, is this partnership we have with our employers and the unique nature of our relationship to our members. We administer three different types of retirement programs, and those different types of retirement programs depend on when the employee came into public service. Tier 1 members were the members who went into the program from inception up till January 1 of 1996. So they had to have been hired prior to that date. In the 1995 legislative session, the legislature created Tier 2. And Tier 2 covers employees who arrived between January of 96 and August of 2003.
You're probably going to get to it right now, but which ones are not in PERS versus which are? Part of PERS. My question there. Which public entities? I'm sorry.
Okay.
Which public entities are part of PERS and which are not?
Chair Smith, the ones that are not are very few and far between, like Umatilla County for their police and fire, I think, or Portland Police and Fire Plan. Portland used to have an independent plan that covered their police and fire, and then they came into to OPSERP when that was created sometime in the mid-2000s. So, like I say, few and far between. I think maybe like the city of Seaside, for example.
No, the Port of Morrow is not in PERS. They created their own retirement.
Right, and I think TriMet, for example, or some pieces of Metro may not be in PERS.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Sure. So back to the different plans that we administer, again, depending on the date. And then OPSERP is for folks that joined public service after August 29th of 2003. So that's an important date in our history and an important date for you to consider as you look at the dynamics of the system and you look and consider what the statutes are governing, as Co-Chair Smith wanted me to emphasize. And that is that in 2003, the legislature created this new successor plan, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, or OPSERP, and put all new employees, everyone who joined public service after that date, into that plan. While it seems like it was only a short 14 years ago, already that component of our plan is the largest by population. In other words, more of our active membership are in the OPSERP program than are in Tier 1 or Tier 2 combined. That shows you when you make an incremental change to a plan like creating OPSERP, which is a lower cost plan than Tier 1 or Tier 2, that it can have an effect in your membership very quickly. However, the legacy costs of having a body of employees grow up through Tier 1 and Tier 2, accrue a retirement, and then actually retire and start receiving a benefit, the legacy costs take a very long time to work their way through a system. So while the membership has changed quickly, the costs of the system are more the legacy costs from those people that have served a career and retired and now have moved on to retirement and are no longer active. The IEP account was created in 2003 as a place to divert member contributions. Member contributions used to go in for Tier 1 and Tier 2 members into a regular account, or the member could elect to have a variable account. A portion of their contributions go there. What happened was in 2003, the legislature diverted those contributions into the individual account program. So it is that program serves a couple of different purposes. For the OPCERT member who joins after this August 28th of 2003, the new program was designed as a split of risk. And by risk, I mean who sits at risk for the funding or the amount of their benefit. The OPCERT pension program is a classic defined benefit. And I'll go through the components of it as they're shown on the sheet there. But the defined benefit piece of OPCERT is funded by the employer themselves. So if a member works for a public employer, then contributions are assessed to that employer to pay for the cost of the OPCERT pension. The IAP, on the other hand, is funded through the member contribution, that 6% of salary that members put into the IAP. And that IAP component gets market earnings and losses. There's no guaranteed rate of return. If the fund investments lose money, members lose money. If they have a good year, members have a good year. So the amount that is in that account and at retirement then, how that converts into a benefit stream for that member depends. The risk of that amount is on the member because they are subject to the market earnings and losses. The defined benefit program doesn't change amounts with investment returns. That's where the employer bears the risk. So in 2003, that risk was assigned, if you will, or allocated by the legislature, IAP to members, OPCERP to employers. And it's an important distinction because prior to that time, the employers bore all of the risk in Tier 1 and Tier 2. So in 2003, they created the shared risk model. It's also called a hybrid retirement plan, having a defined benefit component and something like a defined contribution component. It's where a lot of public employee systems have moved to over the last decade or so. We were just kind of one of the first ones to put that new structure into place. So what it did in 2003 was it really, again, changed the character and nature of the retirement benefits that people are earning through the program, through PERS, as well as created that shared allocation of risk. The Tier 1 and Tier 2 programs are the legacy programs, as I said. And those programs, just real quickly to go through the different aspects of them. In Tier 1, you have a normal retirement age of 58. So a member can retire with full employment at age 58, a general service member. We also have what are called police and fire, or P and F members. Sorry for the acronym, but we got to fit it on the slide. So P and F members are, of course, those people who are in police or fire service. They have an earlier retirement age because their careers generally are shorter, and they have a higher benefit for that shorter time. So in Tier 1, your normal retirement age is 58. In Tier 2, that was raised to 60. OPCERP raises it to 65. You can also, if you have enough service, in other words, 30 years of service, you can also retire for a normal retirement out of Tier 1 or Tier 2. Age 58 with 30 years is required in OPCERP. Why normal retirement is key, and then you see early retirement. Someone can take early retirement starting at age 55 or age 50 for police and fire. If you take early retirement, though, your benefit is reduced. It is actuarially reduced to be equal to what you would normally get at retirement age. So if a person was going to get, let's say, $5,000 a month at age 58, if they retire at age 55, we reduce that benefit so that actuarially it's the same amount of money that the member gets over the same expected lifespan. Calculation methods. So Tier 1 started out as what's called a money match benefit. And it's important to understand these calculation dynamics because they tell you a lot about what's going on in the system and what's maybe left to be affected. Money match was how PERS was when it was created in 1945. And what money match says is the member will make contributions over their career. Those contributions will earn so much over the point of the career. When the member retires, there is a corpus or balance in that account. We will annuitize that account balance. We will match it with funds from the member's employer. So if over the member's career, they work for four different employers. We pull money from four different employers to match that member's account. We annuitize that account over the member's lifespan. And that is how you get a money match benefit. So money match is completely driven, the amount of the benefit is completely driven by what does the member have in their account at the time of retirement. In the late 60s, there was a new methodology that was instituted called Formula Plus Annuity. That took that member account annuity and supplemented it with a formula funded by employers. That methodology lived, if you will, from the late 60s until 81, I think. And then the legislature came in with what's called full formula. Full formula is a benefit that is calculated based on the member's final average salary, their years of service, and a statutory factor. So in Tier 1, that factor for general service is 1.67. What does that mean? A 30-year employee times 1.67 is going to get 50% of their final average salary. 30 times 1.67 is 50. If you work 20 years, you get 20 times 1.67. Or if you work 40 years, 40 times 1.67. But the assumption or the predicate was, in full formula, you're going to get, if you work 30 years, 50% of your final average salary. That benefit is completely driven by those three factors: final average salary, years of service, and the statutory factor, completely irrespective of what your member account balance might be. So the full formula benefit is driven by those three factors. The money match benefit is driven by the member's account balance. Two completely different bases that drive what the member's benefit is actually going to be. In Tier 2, Formula Plus Annuity dropped away when full formula came in, so Tier 2 does not get Formula Plus Annuity as a method, and then OPSERP is full formula. One thing I want to emphasize about these benefit calculation methods that often gets misconstrued: we calculate every retirement on however many methods a member is eligible for. By that I mean, a Tier 1 member comes in for retirement, we will calculate a money match benefit, a Formula Plus Annuity benefit, and a full formula benefit. The member gets the highest of the three. They just get it. They don't choose, they don't elect, they just get whichever one of those methods gives them the highest benefit. Same with Tier 2. We calculate it two different ways, formula and money match. OPSERP, obviously, there's only one calculation method. So it's not a matter of the member electing. It is a matter of automatically the member getting the highest calculation method that generates the highest benefit for them. The full formula factors are set out there, like I say, for Tier 1, Tier 2, it's 1.67 for general service, 2% for police and fire, and then the same for Tier 2. OPSERP is a little lower factor, 1.5, instead of 1.67, 1.8 for police and fire. Off to the right there, you see the IAP column, and that's illustrative of the fact that everybody's 6%, Tier 1, Tier 2, OPSERP, all of their contributions go into the IAP. So the calculations I've talked about, the methodologies I've talked about, statutory factor, final average salary, all that is all relating to the pension costs. The IAP is an individual account, sits over on the side. Since 2004, member contributions have gone into the IAP, and the member just gets that account balance at retirement. They have distribution options at retirement. They can elect to get their payment over 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, or what's called an anticipated lifespan option. They can get those those benefits on a monthly, quarterly, or annual basis, depending on if they meet a minimum $200 per payment threshold. So that's all at the member's election.
Do spouses receive PERS benefits?
Co-Chair Smith, a member, I'm talking about the basic benefit that a member gets.
Right.
And on the pension side.
Right.
On the pension side, once that basic benefit has been determined, the member has 13 different conversion options. some of which include what we call a joint and survivor option. So a joint and survivor option is where the member could choose, instead of just paying for my life, I want you to pay that benefit or my life and my spouse's life, or a child, or just anybody they choose.
Got it. Thank you very much.
And same thing with IAP, that if there's an account balance left when the member dies, that account goes to a beneficiary that they've named.
Thank you.
So some of the other features you hear a lot about in relation to PERS, I just thought I'd talk about some distinctions. One is this issue about lump sum vacation payouts. When a member, when a public employee gets to the end of their career, they may receive a lump sum payout of the accrued vacation that they have. If they are a Tier 1 member, then that lump sum vacation payout is included in their covered salary for contributions. That's 6%. So whatever that payout is, 6% of that will go into their individual account. Same for Tier 2, but not for OPSERP folks.
Co-chair.
Yeah.
We have a question, Mr. Co-chair.
When we're talking about the vacation, how does that happen? Are you able to accrue a lot? Or, for example, my time in the military, we can only carry over 60 days of vacation time at any point. All over that, you either cash it in at that time or you lose it. So how is that, how's that vacation time calculated?
Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Manning, the answer is, unfortunately, it depends. We have 850-some employers. They all have their own policies. For the state, for example, I cannot accrue more than, I cannot be paid out more than 300 hours at the time that I retire. So I have to make sure I retire or leave public service if I go to another job. Anything over 300, it just drops away. Anything 300 under, I get a lump sum payout. That's the state's policy. I would even venture to say that's a state policy to executive staff. I'm not sure if that's the same for every union. I'm not sure if it's the same for management, for every agency. And so it varies across the employers.
Okay, but there is a maximum 300 hours.
For the state.
For the state.
The state as my employer.
Right. Okay, yeah, that's what, okay.
The city of Eugene may have a completely different policy for how many, what the maximum number of hours you can accrue and what your maximum payout would be.
Okay, so does that also include the vacation pay? Does that also include earned sick time as well?
Sick time is the next line down.
And we'll get to that. Okay, all right. Thank you.
Sure. So the lump sum vacation payout, we talked about it for contribution purposes. It does also count in a Tier 1 member's final average salary. Your final average salary is generally your three highest years or three high years of salary. Your lump sum vacation payout is included in that determination if you're a Tier 1. It is not included in Tier 2, and it is not included in OPSERP. Sick leave. So there's a separate program related to sick leave, and that is a special, a different part of the statute, where if an employer elects to participate in this program, so it is at the election of the employer, if the employer elects to participate, one half of the member's accrued sick leave is added to their final average salary at retirement.
Okay, Mr. Co-Chair?
Yeah, please.
So is that the lump sum? Oh, all right, I see it. I just had to look at it. It says it right there. One lump sum payoff, so it doesn't apply to the balance and spread out over a number of years or a cycle or anything like that. Both of these are done at a lump sum pay at retirement, the vacation as well as the unused sick.
Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Manning, that's correct.
Okay.
So you'll get your lump sum vacation payout at retirement. We will take a sick leave balance that your employer reports if that employer participates in the program. And the value of that will be added again, and then it's spread over the 3 years. So it is factored into your three-year average. So to that extent, it's spread out.
Okay.
And I would just also note on the sick leave, you asked about limits. On the sick leave, there is a limit that an employer cannot grant more than 8 hours of sick leave for PERS purposes in every month. That's the limit on how much sick leave a member can accumulate for the PERS program is 8 hours a month. Sometimes, for example, special district firefighters, they'll have completely different leave policies given their different schedules and demands. They have to translate that into per speak, if you will, at the time of a retirement to make sure they stay within that limit.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the benefit programs and the different difference between them?
I have a different question. And I apologize, I'm kind of reading ahead on some stuff.
Okay.
Do you serve as staff as to the Oregon Investment Council?
Co-Chair Smith, no, we do not serve as staff to the Oregon Investment Council.
Okay, thank you.
That's out of the Treasury Investment Division. Got it. So, who gets paid how much? This is just information about the distribution of payments that that occurs out of the PERS, out of PERS. This is for January 1, 2016, just to pick a month as a point in time. 134,323 benefit recipients received monthly benefits. Of that, over 67% of those payments were under $3,000 a month. 27% were between $3,000 and $6,000. 5% then were those $6,000 to $9,000, and then less than 1% were to the $9,000 per month. So the papers always talk about the Coach Pilates of the world and the high benefit earners, as you can see, in relative terms in PERS, they represent a very small portion of the population. So if you want to talk about who makes more than $100,000 in PERS benefits, you're talking about something in that 1%, 2% range. Everyone else, as you see, falls into that very large slice of between $0 to $3,000 a month. That's where most of our benefit recipients lie. And then the average annual benefit is $29,000. The median is $23,000. So, again, not particularly representative when you talk about someone who makes $500,000 a year out of PERS. That's, you know, one or two people.
Yeah, we have a question. Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Co-Chair. And thank you very much for this information. My question regards beneficiaries. And I was contacted recently by a constituent who indicated that his named beneficiary had passed away a number of years ago, and he now does not have the ability to name a new beneficiary. Is this a common situation?
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Gumberg, it is a predictable outcome. And what I mean by that is when a member retires, as I say, they could convert to some 13 different forms of benefit, some of which include a beneficiary. The person that they name as beneficiary is locked in at that time of retirement. They have some 60 days to change it, but that is locked in. And the reason is because we take what the individual member's benefit would have been, and if they add a beneficiary, we actuarially adjust it so the benefits are equal. So if when I retire, let's say I'm age 58 and I name my wife as who's also age 58 as my beneficiary, then together we will get less than I got alone, because there's a chance that one or the other of us is going to outlive the other. So when you have two lives, the benefit goes down a little bit. If instead of at age 58 I name my 58-year-old wife, I name my 28-year-old wife, the benefit goes down even further. Because her lifespan is expected to be much longer than mine. So we have to make
pretty
them
sure
actuarially consistent. I don't think my lifespan would be very long once my 58-year-old wife heard about my 28-year-old wife.
It's going to be a quick.
Mr. Co-Chair,
to finish the answer, that's locked in. So when your beneficiary dies, your payments all along have been predicated on that beneficiary, and it is, for lack of a better term, a gamble as to which one's going to outlive the other.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And just to follow up, is there the opportunity to unname a beneficiary, to take somebody off my beneficiary list?
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Gumberg, one of those 13 benefit options that you can choose is what's called an option 2A or 3A, which relates to your spouse. And you can choose to what's called, you can choose one of those options, and if your spouse then dies or divorces you, you can what's called pop up to your single life benefit. So that's one of the bets that you can make, is that I will outlive my wife or that she will divorce me. And in that case, my benefit will go up. You, again, can make that as an option choice.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you.
So how has PERS been funded? A little background on the PERS funding system funding. The pie shows you where the money comes from. And that is all of our revenue from basically 1970 to 2015. And what it shows you is by far the largest slice of that pie is investment income. We are very dependent on the Oregon Investment Council, which the co-chair referenced earlier, and the good work of our friends in the investment division of the state treasury. The money that employers contribute, the money that members contribute, and all of the accumulated earnings over time are all under their direction. And they have done a exemplary job in relation to other public employee retirement systems in investing those funds. John Shervin, the chief investment officer, could tell you in more detail. But John and I are, and often when we do these presentations together, he talks about their performance over the long term being in the top. So the point is, we are very dependent on their success. 73.4 cents of every dollar basically comes in through that investment and performance. Employer contributions represent 21.1% of the pie. Member contributions, 5.5%. Those member contributions are those legacy regular and variable account contributions that were made prior to 2004. So that's the money that we brought in over that time. And it's important to understand this assumption, because this is how we fund PERS. We'll talk more a little bit later about what the consequence of that funding model is. But basically, when a member comes to work in a PERS-covered employer, we take employer contributions that over that member's career will be sufficient to fund their benefit. So those employer contributions are predicated on the assumption that this person will work a certain amount of time, that they will have a rise in their salary over time, and with the time that they retire, we will have accumulated enough in contributions and, crucially, earnings to pay for that member's retirement. So basically, each individual employee is self-funded. And it's the fact that we invest money over time and have had such success with those investments that means that investment income represents such a large share of the cost of the system. If we were to instead go to what's called a pay-as-you-go system, which means that the contributions made for employees today go to pay for the benefits of people who have already retired, which is what Social Security does as a model, the contribution cost would be much higher because you don't have that investment return to build the funding over time. So funded status, we show it there from 2009 through 2015. We've been through some ups and downs. 2009 was coming off of the Great Recession and a drop in the PERS fund. And then over time, that funded status improved a little bit. You see a big jump in 2013. That's some strong earnings years. That's also the 2013 legislation that reduced the cost of living adjustment for members, which was later overturned by the courts. So that 2013 figure includes the savings from that legislation. The 2014 figure takes those savings away, which is why there's such a big drop from 2013 to 2014. There were some other contributing factors, and we will go through those, but that's why there's that big change from 13 to 14. That's the top line of that is including side accounts. Let me talk about what side accounts are. Individual employers can make a decision to provide what's called a lump sum side account. And what that lump sum side account is it's an advance payment of contributions. So when an employer gives us that lump sum, we amortize that side account over a set period of time, meaning we pull money out of that side account to offset their contributions over time. It means their current contribution rate is lower. So a prominent example of that was the state of Oregon in 2003, fall of 2003, they got an authorization to issue pension obligation bonds. They issued bonds and received the proceeds of those bonds and gave them to us as a side account. Since we got that money, we invested alongside other investments, and as long as our investment returns exceed the cost of the bond, then it was a good play, for lack of a better term, for the state, because they get more money spun off of the side account than it costs them to pay for the debt service of it. The timing of that is really important, and the level of risk on that has grown quite a bit. LFO has a paper that they published recently on pension obligation bonds that would give you a lot more detail behind that if you were interested. But predominantly, that's how those side accounts become funded. So we show the funded status, including side accounts, because that money is in the trust, can't be taken away, is it's mine. You can't have it. So employer money that is definitely going to pay contributions into the future. When we set employer rates, though, we strip those side accounts away. So everybody talks about our funded status excluding side accounts, because that's more of a present funding status, not taking into account these advanced deposits. So you see that in 2015, as a result of the 2015 valuation, we're down to 71% funded without side accounts or excluding side accounts. We're up to 79% funded if you include side accounts.
Well, let me ask a question on this really quick. So as legislators, when we talk to citizens, that $21.8 billion unfunded actuarial liability, does that, can you, what I'm about to share I'm sure is incorrect, so what I'm looking for is to be corrected on this. Is that the amount of money that if all state employees who were looking to retire retired tomorrow, that we would be short the amount necessary to cover their retirement costs?
No, not quite. And if I can jump ahead to this formula, is how we derive the $21.8 billion.
Perfect. Thank you. I'll be patient here.
So the only thing I skipped over was, my goodness, how many people are eligible to retire? I just threw this in because as you consider, again, changes to the system and you're thinking about, well, will that cause a rush to the door? There's a lot of people that could rush out. There's, if you look over to the bottom right, 32.7% of our members in the system are currently eligible to retire by age or by years of service. So we have a lot of people who, for whatever reason, are eligible but have not yet chosen to retire. That's just information we publish generally. So workforce planning, you can think about what effect that might have. I'll come back to that if there's questions, but I want to get to the formula to answer yours. So when you want to talk about PERS, the system, and its status, I always start with this formula because it's math. And the nice thing about math is you cannot have an opinion about math. That $21.8 billion answer is the answer. You may think it's a good answer or a bad answer. It's certainly a troubling and a large answer, but it is the answer. So I like to talk about it in those terms because that puts the proper frame around the facts of the situation. How that $21.8 billion, the number you keep hearing about, is derived is these components of these formulas. And the other reason I like to talk about this math is it's simple math. It's just algebra. Stuff on the left side of the equal sign has to equal the stuff on the right side of the equal sign. That's why the equal sign is there. Benefits represents the present value of the benefits that people have earned at the point in time that we do evaluation. We do a system valuation every year at the close of a calendar year. So the $21.8 billion number that you mentioned, Co-Chair Smith, comes from the 2015 valuation. At the close of the calendar year 2015, the actuaries looked at the balance of this formula. What benefits have already been earned, people who have retired, but also people who have worked in the system and have a vested benefit up to that date? What is the present value of that benefit? That's what the B is.
Got it.
The C and E are the contributions and the earnings. Not the contributions being what have employers contributed over time, and the earnings being what have the investments returned over time, but also contributions into the future and earnings into the future at what's called the assumed rate, which is 7.5% currently. So what the PERS board does is we have to fund the B. We have to fund the benefits. Those benefits are earned and promised. We have to have enough funding on the right side of the equation. We have to assume, we must solve the equation, assume what E will be. We assume E will be set at 7.5% annual earnings. The contribution, the C, is the swing funder. So the contributions, what employers pay as a percentage of payroll, is what brings this formula into balance. Mm. So to answer your question, what is that 21.8? The 21.8, stripping away side accounts, that 21.8 is then the difference between the B and the C plus C.
Yeah.
On a present value basis. So it is not as if everyone retired, because I'll use Linnea for an example. She may not, she may be, but I don't think she's 58 years old. So she is not eligible to retire. But there is a value of benefits that she has earned up to this time.
Mm-hmm.
So that value is factored into that formula.
Got it. Thank you for correcting me on that.
Were there any questions on the eligible to retire? I skipped over it. Senator Manning, you looked like you might have had some question.
Well, you have active and inactive. So I'm assuming that the inactives are what your current retirees are. What is that? Help me understand that.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Manning. Those are people who have left employment but have not yet retired.
Okay.
So we have three kinds of members, active, inactive, and retired. And inactive are people that have left public employment but have not yet retired. So components of this formula are really important to understand in terms of who controls which piece. The benefit piece is controlled by the legislature. You all design the plan. You are the sponsors of the plan. So the value of that B, the value of the benefits, are determined by you and which laws you pass. The laws that you pass that tell us...
That tier one, though, has now been set. And the statute says a contract has been agreed to, and we don't have the ability to overturn a contract.
Co-Chair Smith, thank you for the clarification. My point was, if there are adjustments to the benefits, that's done by the legislature. The courts have told you those adjustments have to be prospective only.
Okay, okay, okay. I didn't mean to cry. I just wanted to
That's all right.
Make sure I understand.
So that benefit is controlled by, my point is, that's determined by or controlled by the legislature. Contributions controlled by the PERS board or set by the PERS board. Earnings are the returns from the invested funds of the Oregon Investment Council. We solve this formula every year. Every other year, it's used to set employer contribution rates. The odd number year valuations are used to set employer contribution rates. So in terms of the legislature and the actions they've taken, what I've given you is just a brief chart that shows the changes to the to PERS benefits. The first slide shows you plan inception through the mid-1990s. The details aren't important. Just look at the green are the improvements to the benefits. The reds are caps or reductions to the benefits. This is the history up to the mid-90s. Here's the history since the mid-90s. Green has turned to red. So without getting into too much detail, I can give you a chapter and verse sometime if you'd like. But the reason that PERS is in the financial situation is the reason there's a $21.8 billion shortfall is because these, green enhancements built up benefits to which people were entitled through the mid-90s. In the mid-90s, corrective actions started, creation of Tier 2, changes to the system in 2003, bills essentially trying to limit the benefits that had already been provided. Co-Chair Smith alluded to the court's review of those efforts. The final review of those efforts, the Morrow decision, said you cannot reduce benefits that have already been earned. Consequently, these red efforts have had a significant effect, but their efforts are limited to prospective changes only. I do this more as a cautionary tale to understand when you're looking at changes to the PERS plan, are you landing on the green? Are you landing on the red? And if you're enhancing benefits in any way, then you're probably going to land on the red side of this ledger. And while it may seem to be a small change, these changes add up over time. So please consider that when you're looking at legislation about PERS. So that's really the legislature's role in this. Let's talk or turn our attention to the PERS board. The PERS board is a 5-member board. They're appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. The governor designates the board chair. There are, of those 5 members, 3 of them have to be independent members. In other words, they cannot be PERS beneficiaries, cannot be PERS members, have to be completely outside the system. 1 member is either a member of a bargaining unit or a retiree from a bargaining unit. The other member is an employee of the state in a management position or holds the elective office of a governing body. So those 5 members, 3 of whom are independent, make the decisions in implementing the PERS program. And their authority that's being delegated them by statute is listed there. So the trustees of the fund, they administer the system to create and maintain long-term stability and viability. We're supposed to publish an actuarial report at least once every 2 years. As I say, we do it every year. Evaluating our current and prospective assets and liabilities and its condition, including mortality, disability, and other experience of the members and employers. They adopt actuarial equivalency factor tables at least once every 2 years. That, Co-Chair Smith, goes to the conversion factor of those member benefits to make sure that you catch up with and keep current with changes in mortality over time. And lastly, of course, adopt rules and take actions necessary to maintain PERS as a federal tax-qualified retirement plan. That's where the federal government comes in and says, as a tax-qualified retirement plan, PERS has to follow certain guidelines and restrictions like that exclusive benefit rule. We have to assiduously guard that tax-protected status. Otherwise, all the benefits that members have would be presently taxed to them instead of being taxed as income when they actually retire, as they receive them after they retire. So the rate setting cycle, as I say, we do these valuations every year. The odd numbered years are the ones that we use to set employer contribution rates. So the valuation date is always at the end of a calendar year. Then the employer contribution rates that are derived from that valuation take effect about 18 months later. So the rates that we're paying today, employers are paying today in PERS, are based on the 2013 valuation. We have already conducted the 2015 valuation. The results of that were used to set employer rates that go into effect July 1 of 2017. We will close evaluation at the end of this calendar year, 2017, to adopt employer rates that go into effect July 1 of 2019. So we always use the odd-numbered valuation to set contribution rates for 2 years.
So let me ask a question.
Sure.
And I'm trying to think about a balance sheet and accrual liability that we owe, but with a financial statement also comes an income statement that talks about income opportunities coming into the state. Is part of the solution to the PERS issue just time and allowing those who are within Tier 1 to go through a cycle? And then, to allow the state's economy to grow and to know that revenues over time, just simply through nothing more than inflation, that's nothing else, will grow as well.
Can I put that off? Because I have many slides to show you exactly how that dynamic plays over time.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry, colleagues, I apologize for getting out front.
No, okay, thank you. That's a good question.
Okay. So just to lay a little more foundation, sorry, co-chair, but I will get to that. In solving this equation, solving this B equals C plus C and setting the contribution rate, these are some basic principles the PERS board follows. They want to be transparent as to process and inputs. All of the information that we use to set rates, all of the actuarial reports, all of it is available on our website. Is it deep and dark and tedious to get through if you're not an actuary? Yes, sure it is. We try to make it as simple and direct as we can, but it's all up there, and it's all, again, it's driven by math. So we can always show you the math behind how we got from one point to the next. Predictable and stable rates would be great, except that's the second bullet. The third bullet is we want to protect the funded status of the system. So we'd like to tell employers your rates are going to be this for an extended period of time. The problem is if market returns drop, for example, we need to adjust contribution rates to start filling that hole sooner. We try to be equitable across generations. That's that point I was making earlier about my contributions pay for my benefit, not my contributions pay for somebody else's benefit that's currently retired. So we strive for that generational equity. And lastly, of course, we want to be actuarially sound. GASB compliant, sorry, that's an acronym, Government Accounting Standards Board. Government Accounting Standards Board sets the standard for government accounting, and we obviously want to make sure that we comply with their standards. So to break down the rates, and this is a start, Representative Smith, Co-Chair Smith, of answering your question. Over on the right three columns, you see the 2017-19 rates for PERS. They're broken down by Tier 1, Tier 2, OPSERP, and then weighted average. Weighted average is just the average based on the fact of how many Tier 1, Tier 2 members are in the system versus OPSERP. Because it's two different rates, you have to average them across the population. This is a system-wide representation. As I say, 850-plus some employers, no employer is average. They're all different. But this shows you, if you roll it all up aggregately, what the system dynamic looks like. That first line is called normal cost. That is that current contribution that is made for the service that I provide as a PERS employee, PERS covered employee. So that normal cost is what it normally costs to pay for the benefit that an individual earns while they are working. So as you see, OPSERP, the normal cost is 8.56%. That's a percentage of payroll or percentage of salary. So 8.56% of my salary, if I was an OPSERP member, would pay for the benefit that I'm earning as an OPSERP member. Where PERS rates are going up is in the function of this unfunded actuarial liability, or UAL, the $21.8 billion number that we've thrown around. Tier 1 and Tier 2 UAL, you see there the rate went from 6.63% of payroll in 15-17 up to 16% of payroll in 17-19. 10% jump as a percentage of payroll in that unfunded liability. Remember that big jump from 2013? The UAL was down around 2, I think. Sorry. The unfunded liability went in 2013 from $2.6 billion, now up to $16.2 billion. If you drop out side accounts, $8.5 billion up to $21.8 billion. It's that big jump in UAL that we recover with this rate. Now, that unfunded liability, that slice of unfunded liability from the 15 valuation, is recovered on a level percent of payroll over 20 years. And we assume that that's going to be recovered at the assumed rate of 7.5%. So this 16% of payroll as a UAL rate is to pay that $21.8 billion over 20 years at a level percent of payroll. When I say level percent of payroll, Co-Chair Smith, you asked about growth in the economy. Mm-hmm. We assume covered payroll grows 3.5% a year. So we're assuming a growth in payroll, but a level percent of payroll. So 16% of that growing payroll over 20 years will retire this debt if we earn 7.5%. Hmm. OPSERP has its own unfunded liability. It's about $1 billion. That, again, is spread over the entire payroll. So on average, employers would have an uncollared rate. I'll talk about what the collar is in just a second. But employers would have an uncollared rate of 29.08% of payroll, up from the current average of 18.18% of payroll. So a 10.5% increase in employer payroll this biennium. Remember, one of the principles the PERS Board follows is predictable and stable rates. To support predictable and stable rates, the PERS Board has a policy to collar increases in employer rates from one biennium to the next. So the details of that collar are in a slide later, but basically they're 20% of payroll. So what that means is that your employer rate cannot go up more than one-fifth of what it currently is. So that's where this collar limitation comes in. Instead of rates going up 10.5% of payroll, we're collaring off 8.23% of that increase. So the base rate is only going up to 20.85%. Then you put in side accounts, which again are individual to employers, but on a system-wide basis. Side accounts are going to offset about 6% of that. So the collared net rate is 14.23% of payroll. And that's an increase of 3.6%. So 20% of 18 is 3.6. That's about how the collar works. It is, again, individual employer by individual employer. Your results may vary, but that's generally how, on a system-wide basis, the progression works. What I think is really important to take away from this is the focus on normal cost. If you're looking at changes in the benefits, that normal cost piece is the only thing that you have to work with. That 8.56%. Instead of a new member who comes in tomorrow into PERS, if they come in under a reduced benefit structure, you're reducing that 8.56. This large rate of 29.08, that's not because the benefits that we're getting today cost 30% of payroll. The benefits we're getting today cost 8.5% of payroll. The benefits for the people who have already retired cost 16% of payroll. So I note the sources of the unfunded liability increase from the 14 and 15 valuations. That moral case, that's the adjustment there in the third line down. That's $5.1 billion of an increase into the unfunded liability. But note also there's a couple of other drivers. We decreased the assumed rate to 7.5%. That adds to the unfunded liability. The assumed rate, again, is what the PERS board, based on what the Oregon Investment Council allocates, how they allocate their assets. That assumed rate is what the PERS board thinks investments will earn over the next 20 years. By decreasing that to 7.5%, remember the pie of revenue that was 73 cents of every dollar's investments? If you assume a lower rate, that part of the pie shrinks, the employer contribution has to grow. So that's what adds to the unfunded liability. Updating mortality assumption. We do an experience study, as I say. How did our actual experience compare to how we the actuaries, projected our experience in any given cycle? In 2014, what the actuaries told us is not that we have underestimated mortality currently, but we weren't anticipating a fast enough growth rate in mortality. So not that the people who are retiring today, we didn't have paid pretty well, but the people that are going to retire 10 or 15 years from now, probably we weren't seeing their growth in mortality as quickly as we should. So we had to adjust that assumption to make sure that, again, we collect contributions now for the people that are going to be retiring 10 or 15 years, probably going to live a little longer, probably cost a little more money. That adds to the unfunded liability. In 2015, that expected UAL increase, that's a function of the fact that we collared employer rates. So we expect the unfunded liability to go up because we didn't jump right to that 29% employer rate. So we expect the UAL is going to go up during 2015. We had actual investment returns in 2015 well below assumption. They were more around 2% instead of 7.5%.
Let's do this really quick. I want to make sure everyone understands. When you say collared,
right?
Define that term for everyone.
Sure. That's what I was talking about here, right? Between the collar limitation and this slide. Whoa, it's in here. This illustrates the PERS rate collar policy. So it's just a PERS board policy to limit how much employer rates go up from one biennium to the next. And when you have a big jump like we did in 14 and 15 because of these huge increases in unfunded liability, it takes a couple biennia to work through those increases. Mm-hmm. So this slide just breaks out the funded status and unfunded liability, kind of pulls all those dynamics together for 2013, 14, and 15, and shows you, you know, the moral decision wasn't a factor in 13. the experience study changes and the assumed rate and mortality assumptions were not. So that's why there was such a big jump from 13 to 14 and then to 15. So here's to your point about growth in employer contribution rates and growth over time. We're right now in 15-17. Difference between the light gray is the base rates, the dark gray is the net rates. Net are net of those side account offsets. So the side, the dark blue, dark gray, is what employers are actually paying on a net basis after the side account contribution. Right now they're paying 10.5%. It's going to go up to 14.2% of payroll. Because of the collar, you see these bars go up every biennia until the 21-23 biennia, second from the right. That's because there's only so much we can increase every biennia under the current policy. So we get up to what I call a cruising altitude of about 32% of payroll. And then that net basis knocks it down to 25.3. The net rates, again, are the side account offset. So if you go into the biennia after that, sorry, I jumped a little weird. That was a, so 23, 25, we've hit the cruising altitude. We stay at that altitude out for another five biennia until the current unfunded liability is amortized out, because we amortize that over 20 years. Mm-hmm. The net rates become no different in the 2029-31 biennia because those side accounts are all amortized to end at the same time in the 27-29 biennia. So net rates go away, base rates become net rates, but the funding costs for those pension obligation bonds also go away. So once we hit 29-31, employers are paying their full freight, no more side accounts, no more offsets. And then again, contributions start trending down because that unfunded liability wears away after 20 years, so long as everything goes to assumption. And from a budget subcommittee standpoint, understand nothing ever goes to assumption. So we'll talk about some probabilities of changes. Talked about the rate collar. Also, questions about amortization again. LFO's published a paper on this. The amortization period is currently 20 years. Why 20? Why not 25 or 30? Wouldn't the employer contribution rates be lower? Yes, they would, but look at the risk that you run. These graphs show you the amortization structure if you extend out to 30 years. That's that hashed part of the graph. And the point is, the dotted line is what our current $21.8 billion is. If you put that payment out over 30 years, you don't start paying down the principal for 20, because you have what's called negative amortization. Your payments don't pay enough of the principal, don't pay enough to actually reduce the principal. So you're out there for 20 years before you start digging out of the hole. If you did a 25-year amortization, it's about 10 or 12 years before you start paying down the principal. Something is going to happen in terms of the economy, a correction, a change in the market, and you're in worse shape when that happens under longer amortization. That's why we limit amortization to 20 years, because then at least you're not digging the hole deeper for a long period of time. And, of course, it costs more. 20 years, that $21.8 billion is going to actually cost $44.609 million in actual repayment because, again, you're paying it over 20 years. But if you extended the amortization out to 30 years, you pay $63 billion mm-hmm. for that $21.8 billion. These charts just illustrate, under different return assumptions, what happens if to the funded status if we just held 17-19 rates steady. So why do we adjust rates? Why do we increasing rates? Why are we increasing rates to 30%? The funded status of the system currently sits right there at 71%. The green line shows you what happens at a 9% rate of return. The blue line, 7.5%. Orange, 7%. Red, 5% rate of return. If you just held 17-19 rates steady and we were able to earn 9% a year 20 years from now, we're 100% funded and everything's great. That's maybe an unrealistic expectation of our friends at the investment division. 9% per year is a pretty heavy lift. We are assuming 7.5%, that's the blue line, which means we hold steady at 70% funded, trend down slightly. 7%, trend down even more. 5%, your funded status gets down almost to 20%. That's, again, if you held 17-19 rates steady, which is why you see the projected increases in rates beyond 17-19 for 19-21, 21-23. The unfunded liability just goes through the roof. Right now, we're again at this 21.8. Sure, at 9%, again, 17-19 rates held steady. At 9%, that UAL goes down. At 5%, it goes up to almost $100 billion because you're not paying it down.
Right.
And this just shows you the effect of the collared rates. So right now we're at this 15-17 collared base rates, 17-19. Again, under almost any return scenario, there's no divergence because we still have to climb out of the collar.
Can you go back one more slide?
Sure.
On that 5%
right.
rate of return.
Right.
Well, let's start with what's the likelihood we could get 9%? What's the likelihood we could get 7.5? What's the likelihood we could even average 5% over that period of time?
So thank you, Co-Chair Smith. Every November, the actuaries do extensive financial modeling. And these are straight line estimates. What they do is what's called a stochastic model, which looks at thousands of different return scenarios every year. And they assign those different probabilities. So the 7.5% return is in the 50-60% probability. Your 5% is down, you know, towards the, I don't know for sure, but more like down towards the fifth percentile. Your 9% is up more like the 95th percentile.
But at 5%, based upon the model, they think that, while very conservative, is realistic.
It is possible.
Possible.
And they're not model. They don't model to assign what's most likely to happen. It's just to show you under all kinds of different return scenarios where the funded status might go.
And so, what level of risk is there on 5%? I'm assuming the risk is significantly less than a 9%
of investment risk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Of course, it would be.
Right.
You would have a much less volatile portfolio at 5%.
No, and so as legislators, part of what we have to take into consideration is, yeah, we'd love to have that 9%, but the risk that associated with that is much higher. What am I missing, John?
Pardon me, Co-Chair. I think, and Steve, you can correct me if I'm wrong, these are rates of return, so they assume the existing PERS portfolio performs at 5%, and you can correct me, versus the portfolio structured to produce 5%. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So it's a little bit different of a way to look at this. So because the PERS portfolio in theory is structured to return the assumed rate of 7.5%. And so this is saying, well, what would happen under certain circumstances if that return were less? What would it do to the UAL and the rates and everything? So,
is that and again, holding 17-19 rates constant.
Yeah, that does. Yeah. Okay. Please continue.
Well, LFO staff raises a good point, and that is always this balance between what is the asset allocation and what is the assumed rate of return. It's a very much a chicken and an egg, but we look at it as the OIC is charged with a prudent investment structure. They will assign asset allocation as they deem that to be prudent. The assumed rate is just a derivative off of that asset allocation. So they could, if the directive were from the legislature to return 9%, they could put a portfolio together that would do that. Unfortunately, the risk that it would be successful is very small, and the volatility of that portfolio would be substantial. Similarly, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear, but that's the 5% answer. If you want a 5% rate of return, it would be a much more conservative portfolio, much less volatile, but the consequences are that either your funded status erodes or your contribution rates go through the roof. So.
Thank you.
that's what this graph shows you is, again, if you just had a 5% return, but then employer rates climbed to 40% of payroll. On the other hand, if we were able to achieve a 9% return at the end of this 20-year period, you're almost at zero. So these are just illustrative. Like I say, the financial modeling looks at probabilities across thousands of scenarios, and these dots are more like candlesticks of probability. So here's the extremes of each, and then the middle ground being what's more likely to happen. But we pull from that financial modeling, again, as a budget subcommittee, here's what I would emphasize to you as far as likelihood, and this gets, again, back to some of your points. So what is the likelihood over the next, this is our November 2016 modeling, 10,000 investment return scenarios. Over the next 20 years, the probability at some point will be 100% funded is 59%. 59 out of 100 of those scenarios show us at some time being over 100% funded. 64% of those scenarios show us falling below 60% funded status. And 13% of that scenario show us falling below 40% funded. And the base rate being greater than 30% of pay is 80% probability. So that 30% of payroll bar that I showed you is the cruising altitude. That's like 8 out of 10 probability. That's what the next 20 years looks like. I'm glad the sun came outside because I'm going to really darken the mood around here. As you look at other agency budgets and as other employers look at their budgets over the next biennia, we threw this one in too, which is over the next three biennia, July 1 of 2019, 2021, and 2023, what is the probability that the collared employer rate will increase 3% of pay? 94% probability that that's going to happen at some point in the next three biennia. That it's going to go up by 4% of pay, 91%. 5% of pay, it's only 3 out of 4. That at some point are going to have a 5% of pay increase. So PERS is a driver of cost. PERS is very probable to continue to be a driver of increased costs over the next several biennia, over the next 20 years, barring about the only thing you can say will change that outcome is an investment return scenario like the green line we've illustrated here, probability of which is pretty small.
Or politically, the legislature decides to enhance employer contributions.
Well, the PERS board will set the contributions.
That formula,
just to go back to that, your opportunities on the B side of the equation.
So as I correct me if I'm wrong here, but as I look at your formula and I accept that, really you have three options. One, public employees could say, why didn't I see the light? Yes, take away my benefits. Chances are that's not going to occur. Or the legislature could enhance contributions through additional injections. Or the Oregon Investment Council could assume greater risk and take on hope with some probability of success or failure of greater earnings.
Right. And Co-Chair Smith, I'm sorry if I confused your point about contributions. The board sets the contributions, but were the legislature to come up with more revenue that they dedicated into this formula on the contribution side, that would be kind of stepping in to rebalance this formula in a different way than has been done previously.
Sure.
My focus was more on the B side because that's the legislature's province. But there, again, I emphasize that B is going to be 30% of payroll. Your only place to make a change is on this normal cost. So, 8.56%. If you were to say nobody gets any PERS benefits from this point forward, that 30 comes down to like 22.
Well, and as that cost continues to grow, knowing that the legislature supports school districts and community colleges and universities, that becomes a much greater portion of their payroll costs and reduces the number of teachers, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, and this is a slide where we break down the different entities and what they're looking at as increases. State agencies, their increase is going up $260 million in this next biennium. School district's $335 million. You, as you say, Co-Chair Smith, the state picks up a big share of school district costs. So a big part of that $335 million is going to be handed over to you. And then, of course, all other local government units are looking at $290 million increase. Overall, employer contributions for 2017-18 are going to go up $885 million in the next biennium. And then again, that's 2017-18. 2019-21, you're looking at an even bigger increase. 2021-23, an even bigger incremental increase over these.
Yeah, Representative.
What's the total contribution in dollar figures for this biennium among the entities? Do you know? An $800 million increase.
So that's the bottom line there, Co-Chair Smith, Representative Marsh. The projected 1570 contributions is the second column there, two billion in contributions. Right. 17-19, that's going to go up to $2.9 billion. That's the second from the right column.
Thank you.
And that's, again, on a $20 billion payroll. So I'll move over this quickly only because this unfunded liability is projected to grow because of that, again, limit on the collar, meaning we're not paying the full UAL. So when you hear 21.8, everything else being equal, we're actually going to grow over the next several years until the collar, top of that collar is hit and contributions start knocking this down. Co-Chair Smith, you asked about when will this problem go away?
Right.
these two slides represent that. This first slide shows that this is the payments to members over the next 30 years, and the blue are tier one, the orange is inactive and the green is active.
Wow.
That dotted line that's across this chart shows you where all those bars topped out before the Morrow decision. So the Supreme Court reversing those COLA limits added all of that space above the dotted line. That's why the current unfunded liability went up. So it wasn't all in green, but it was all those bars were capped and they moved up that far. Currently, we pay about $4 billion in benefit payments. By 2040, that's going to double.
Mm-hmm.
So that is another nugget to put in your assumptions or knowledge about PERS. I'll talk more about it tomorrow when I talk about the agency budget. But we put out a lot of money. And it's, again, when I say a lot of money, it's money that's in the PERS fund generated from investments, member and employer contributions. But when they talk about the growth of state budget, we count in that. So just this component of the state budget is going to double over the next 25 years. Not again because more salaries are being paid or more services are being provided. That's just to pay the benefits for people that are in retirement.
Have we calculated those projected benefit payments against the future value of the dollar to see, you know, as inflation?
Co-Chair Smith, we have not. We assume,
my parents bought a home in 74 for $32,000.
Yeah. Yeah, we assume a rate of inflation that is greater than the cost of living adjustment. The cost of living right now, as you know, after 2013 is 1.25% for service going forward. People who retired previously, it was 2%. So there's always going to be, as long as inflation hits assumption, there will always be a degradation in purchasing power.
Mm-hmm.
Every year we publish a purchasing power report, which shows you if you retired in this year, your dollar from that year is worth this now. And, you know, it varies year by year depending on inflation. The reason I'm a bit equivocal is because we're in such a low inflation mm-hmm. environment. People that retired in the late 90s are about on a 1-to-1. But if you retired in the 70s, you've had quite a bit of that value eaten away. So we haven't done it going forward, but we certainly have that purchasing power study every year. So, sorry. This is the when will this problem go away? The blue here are tier one, the orange are tier two, the green are OPSERP. Again, today I pay about $4 billion a year to Tier 2 members. 30 years from now, I'm still paying, I'm sorry, I think I said Tier 2. I pay $4 billion a year pretty much to Tier 1 members. 30 years from now, I'm still paying about $4 billion a year to Tier 1 members. It takes a very long time for legacy problems to work their way out of a retirement system. And you'll see those benefits go up in the middle years. 10, 15 years out, that bulges because more and more Tier 1 members are going to retire. They're going to get a cost of living increase. And when they die, some of them have beneficiaries. So the payment structure will persist for Tier 1s for quite a while. And then, of course, Tier 2 will lay on top, and ops or provincially will come in. So that concludes my presentation for today. We give you some resource information, lots of stuff up on our website. Contact me or my senior policy director, Marjorie Taylor, if you have any questions. Marjorie would also want me to let you know, since some of you are new to PERS, she's your contact for constituent inquiries or questions. She'll jump right on anything you have to say that you need to get an answer to somebody for.
Yeah, she's excellent.
Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Well, sir, this has been a lot of information.
Yeah.
Really, really overload. Well presented.
You see the overload.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine we're going to digest this evening and probably have additional questions tomorrow.
Sure.
How do you want to do this? What do we want to do, John? You didn't want to make a presentation. You were going to hold till the end?
Right.
Okay. John, anything you want to add to this? Or? Right. All right. Any other questions? Mr. Coach, are we okay to adjourn?
We are good.
All right. Michael, we good?
Sir.
All right. We're going to adjourn for the afternoon. Whew. Afternoon. Whew. We're going to adjourn for the